including two-state solution, is really an excuse for a status quo.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate your contribution. Masoud Shajara, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in Tehran, and Zainul Abidin Gaddafi, Coordinator of the Zakzaki Foundation South Africa in Cape Town.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut-taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ المكذبين. إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين. وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون. بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, Serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Israel presses ahead with its airstrikes on the Gaza Strip after agreeing to a temporary truce, which the regime now says will not start until at least Friday. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has carried out several fresh strikes against Israel's military sites, causing casualties. And Iran's president says Israel has failed to achieve its goals in the Gaza war, adding that all the regime's supporters are complicit in its crimes. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
The top story for this half hour. More Palestinians have lost their lives as Israel carries out new airstrikes on Gaza. That's despite the regime's expected truce agreement with the Palestinian resistance movement to pause the war on the besieged strip. Regime forces struck Abu Iskandar, an area in close proximity to the Indonesia hospital in northern Gaza. Multiple strikes were also reported elsewhere, including Deir al-Bala and Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza, as well as Khan Yunis and Rafah in the south. Since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, more than 14,500 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. Over 7,000 people have been reported missing. On Wednesday, the warring sides agreed to a four-day truce mediated by Qatar and Egypt, but it has not gone into effect.
The agreement will last for 4 days after it takes effect. Israel will suspend its military actions in Gaza. During the truce, the Israeli regime is committed not to abduct anyone all across the besieged territory. Palestinians will be free to move from northern to southern Gaza via Salah ad-Din Road. Also, according to the deal, air traffic will completely stop during the 4-day ceasefire in the southern Gaza Strip. In the north, however, air traffic will stop daily for 6 hours from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Hamas says it will release 50 Israeli captives in exchange for the freedom of 150 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Last but not least, hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid, including fuel and medicine, will be given access to all areas of the Gaza Strip.
The temporary ceasefire was expected to start on Thursday, but the Israeli regime says the truce that includes a prisoner swap will not start until at least Friday. The deal was clinched despite a fierce opposition from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet. However, Netanyahu backed the agreement while vowing to continue the genocidal onslaught on Gaza. Well, since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught against Palestinians on October the 7th, the regime has sought to destroy the resistance groups there. However, Palestinians' resistance turned the Gaza Strip into a quagmire for Israeli troops. forcing the regime to redefine its objectives. Here's the main objectives Israel had been pursuing in its war on Gaza.
Israeli officials repeatedly stated the destruction of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as their main objective by targeting the group's military infrastructure. However, since day one, Hamas has been a thorn in the eye of the occupation regime as resistance fighters continued their retaliatory attacks on Israeli targets. Therefore, the regime has failed to achieve its main goals.
And it's just in breaking news that we have from Gaza, according to an Al-Shifa doctor. That's a hospital in northern Gaza. They're stating that the hospital director, Mohammed Abu Samia, has been arrested by Israeli forces. So more details on that story as we get it for you. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has carried out several strikes against Israel's military sites in response to the regime's brutal aggression against Gaza. Hezbollah said it targeted the positions of Israeli soldiers and vehicles in Al-Rahib near Lebanon's southern border with Burkan rockets causing casualties. The movement also targeted several Israeli posts in Bayad Belida, as well as other military targets, including a number of Israeli barracks with appropriate weapons. Meanwhile, Israeli warplanes raided a number of areas in southern Lebanon, including the village of Beit Yahoun. According to a statement by Hezbollah, the strike killed five members of the movement, including the son of the head of Hezbollah's parliamentary bloc, Mohammad Raad. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, has talked to some Lebanese citizens about a truce to halt Israel's war on the Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen how people react to the truce agreement between the Israeli regime and the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas.
The steadfastness of the resistance proved that the occupation could not complete its mission or achieve any military objective, and even on the issue of the prisoners, they were forced to negotiate. Therefore, we consider any truce that is agreed upon by the resistance would be a new achievement for the resistance and the steadfast people of Palestine, at least in this phase, which is considered a partial deal until we reach a stage of emptying Israeli jails from Palestinian prisoners.
The truce is a demand for the resistance since it realizes the most important objective of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, which is the liberation of the Palestinian prisoners in the jails of the Israeli occupation. The resistance also achieved an important gain, which is that the enemy was forced to concede. The enemy had said there would be no ceasefire before Hamas and Islamic Jihad released all the Israeli prisoners.
For what really matters, as the Western humanity fails, over and over again, as the Palestinians are being massacred, Palestinian children are being shredded into pieces, as the world stands idle, as we are dehumanized over and over again, the only response to the Israeli atrocities, to what's going on in Palestine and in the south of Lebanon, is resistance. We will stand by our resistance. And the only way to get our freedom, because we are the oppressed people here, and we'll stand by our resistance, we will raise our voices, we will not wait for your humanity, because your humanity failed.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Israel has failed to achieve any of the goals it pursued in the war on Gaza.
Killing women and children is not victory. Why did the Israeli regime enter Gaza? It said it wanted to capture Gaza, but it failed. It said its goal was to eliminate Hamas, but it couldn't do that. It said it wanted to do away with the resistance, but it failed. The regime has so far had no achievement.
Raisi is speaking in an interview with five Arab television channels. He said the regime's atrocities have only increased awareness of people across the globe about the plight of Palestinians. Iran's president added that people of the world now hate the regime and its backers more than ever. Raisi said Operation Al-Aqsa Flood dealt a heavy military and intelligence blow to the Zionist regime. He added that the Israeli regime collapsed after October the 7th, that is when the operation was launched, but
the U.S. Helped to revive it.
After October 7, it can be said that the regime really collapsed. It was the Americans who came and helped it survive. The reason why Americans and other Western officials rushed to the occupied territories was that they were seriously worried. Some of them told officials in the region that they felt the regime collapsed all of a sudden.
Raisi said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal and intends to go ahead with the aggression against Gaza. Iran's president stressed that all countries that support Israel are complicit in its crimes against Palestinian people. He also called on all Muslim states to sever their relations with the occupying entity. Well, we do have more breaking news now coming out of Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry has stated that the Israeli regime has ordered the Indonesian hospital to be evacuated within 4 hours. Just earlier, we had news of the director of the Al-Shifa hospital being arrested by Israelis. We are going to keep you posted on all the latest developments with regards to the Israeli war on Gaza. Joining us now from Doha is director of the Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, to offer us more insight on this ongoing massacre taking place against Palestinians in Gaza. Mr. Mohammed, let's start off with your thoughts on announced truce with the Palestinian resistance groups based in Gaza. Many are pointing that the Israelis have failed to achieve any of their objectives, and that's why they're in this position right now.
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that the massacres have been ongoing yesterday, and as of yet, there's been no pause in the massacring and the fighting. So, but yes, from the Israel's own objectives, which they said was to defeat Hamas, and that they wouldn't negotiate with them, and that they would release all the hostages through their own military, then they failed in that. Clearly, 47 days later, they failed to dislodge or defeat Hamas in Gaza. They failed in that respect, and they've also had a massive failure in terms of their global propaganda machine, their war machine globally, which until recently has been, if you like, portrayed as a moral army, an invincible army, and the world is seeing what Israel's army is in reality. Their achievements to date are massacring 14,000 people, destroying schools, destroying mosques, destroying houses, and destroying hospitals and healthcare systems. So it seems like they're waging war on people and buildings, and trying to destroy all the means of livelihood for the people of Gaza, so that they would flee into Egypt. And of course, there are operations going in the West Bank, where, you know, to over 206 people had died until recently, and people are being arrested. They're hoping people will flee to Jordan there. So even in this objective of displacing the Palestinian people, despite all the suffering, have not fled. They've not gone to Egypt, and this has shocked them, the resilience of the Palestinian people. To stay in their homeland, not be annexed, not be ethnically cleansed, is a great shock to the Israeli military. So they haven't really achieved any success. And of course, we don't know the numbers that of Israeli soldiers and vehicles that have been destroyed, but the sort of anecdotal evidence that's coming out seems to show that they've incurred losses.
We've got our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who's joining us from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Ashraf, it's great to have you with us. A number of developments within the hour regarding, first of all,
the ceasefire agreement being delayed. More Israeli raids have continued across the Gaza Strip, and just recently we had news of the director of the Al-Shifa hospital being arrested by the Israelis, and the Indonesian hospital has been given a warning to evacuate within 4 hours. Help us better understand what's happening right now.
Well, Badia, regarding the humanitarian pause, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has termed it, it's still hanging there. Nothing concrete. The Hamas was saying yesterday, 10 a.m. today, that didn't happen. I mean, it's not 10 a.m. yet, but the Israeli regime has denied agreeing for 10 a.m. They kept saying that it's not going to happen before Friday. While as of last night, around 6 p.m., Israeli fighter jets and Israeli tanks carried hundreds of air raids and artillery attacks, as well as Israeli gunboats shelling the coastline of Nusayrat, Gaza, Khan Yunis, and Rafah throughout the night until the early hours of the morning. And the attacks, the artillery attacks, mainly concentrated or targeted areas east of the southern Gaza Strip towns of Rafah and Khan Yunis, as well as Johr al-Dik, that's just adjacent to the Gaza Wadi or Gaza Valley in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. That's the last village near the Gaza Valley. On average right now, between 200 to 300 people are being killed every night. Yesterday, 280 people have been killed. Until the early hours of this morning, at least 80 in Khan Yunis. We're not sure about the numbers in Gaza, but there are dozens of deaths in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip. Now, regarding Shifa Hospital, early reports suggest that Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, director of Shifa Hospital, was arrested. But we have to understand that all the injured, the patients, and the medical staff inside Shifa hospitals are already being held hostage by the Israeli regime. They're not necessarily arrested by the Israelis. There are hostages inside Shifa hospital. While the Indonesian hospital is completely vacant right now, at least as far as the injured are concerned, because last night, hundreds of injured and injured and the patients were driven by buses on Saladin Road. They went into Israeli checkpoint, and some of the ambulance drivers and hospital drivers were detained by the Israeli regime forces on Saladin Road near the Nisarim checkpoint. Now, those who the patients and the injured who brought out of the Indonesian hospital, most of them came here to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, as well as the Gaza European Hospital in Khan Yunis, while a few dozen of them were taken to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah. It's worth mentioning that although they were brought here, that doesn't mean they're going to receive medical care, because there is no medical care here. Basically, it's first aid. This is all what the doctors and the medics can do here, because there are no medicines in Khan Yunis hospitals, including Nasser Hospital, no anesthesia, nothing. You can hardly find gauze to wrap the limbs of wounded people.
Ashraf, we know that there's been a heavy emphasis during this onslaught on Gaza on the health sector by the Israelis. They've totally, as you've pointed out, totally devastated the health apparatus in northern Gaza. Help our viewers better understand why the Israelis are doing this. What are the motives for the Israeli regime by totally obliterating the health system in Gaza?
Well, since day one of this war, the Israeli regime has made a point very clear. They want to get rid of everyone in the Gaza Strip. They want to transfer them, to move them out towards the Sinai Peninsula. And by targeting hospitals, targeting schools, targeting mosques and churches, and also the water infrastructure, the electricity grids, and the farmlands, the destruction, the chaos and mayhem they're causing. They want to make sure that at one point when this war ends, and it will end at one point, that the Palestinians who made their way to the southern part of the Gaza Strip will have nothing to go back to. I mean, literally, there is nothing for us to go back to. My house was destroyed on the third day of the war. I mean, if I go now, there is nothing I can do there. There is no water, no electricity, no home, nothing.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Students of Stanford University have vowed to continue weeks-long protest until the U.S. university divests from Israel and condemns the Zionist regime's war crimes in Gaza and occupied territories. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, since the war erupted, students have reported being abused by staff who have accused them of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, among other slurs. Organizers of the sit-in said that since they launched their protest, administrators have only interacted with them on one occasion and have refused to commit to anything other than provide resources for Palestinian students. Earlier this week, Stanford administrators said they would establish two groups aimed at combating hatred and providing community members with support. The first is a new subcommittee designed to combat anti-Semitism, while the other would be a newly established committee for Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian communities that would be expected to address Islamophobia on the campus. The initiative came more than a week after Abdul Wahab Omira, an Arab student at Stanford, was hit by a car in what is being described as a hate crime. A preliminary investigation by the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office described it as a hate crime. The sheriff's office told Middle East Eye that the investigation was still ongoing, adding there were no further updates at this time. Stanford University's media office did not reply to Middle East Eye's request for comment. Across the U.S., there has been a groundswell of support for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, with student bodies issuing statements and engaging in several protest actions, much to the chagrin of university administrators, the Biden administration, and the Zionist regime's government. Students who have espoused pro-Palestine positions or called for a ceasefire have been routinely described by administrators or pro-Israel students as terror sympathizers. Several students have lost job opportunities or have had their identities plastered on blacklists on mobile LED screens outside the campuses and online forums like the Canary Mission, which targets activists who speak out on the Zionist regime's crimes. These actions have followed well-documented pressure exerted by billionaire donors and politicians to quell sentiment interpreted as anti-Israel. Students noted that there has been a concerted effort to conflate pro-Palestinian advocacy with anti-Semitism. This has helped create an environment in which university authorities have been accused of using anti-Semitism to discredit pro-Palestinian activism on campuses and inevitably characterize their advocacy as support for terrorism. In Florida, the state university system was recently told to ban students of Justice in Palestine, SJP, chapters across campuses in the state on the basis that the students were providing harmful support for terrorist groups, as they claimed. At Columbia University in New York City, both the SJP and the local Jewish Voice for Peace chapter were suspended until the end of the semester. At a rally earlier this week at Columbia, one Jewish student who addressed protesters at the school said that the university's decision to suspend the JVP, the only Jewish anti-Zionist group on campus, sent a chilling message to students that Judaism and the State of Israel was one and the same. Columbia University did not reply to Middle East Eye's request for comment. One Palestinian student at Stanford, who also requested anonymity, said that he found himself oscillating between feelings of horror at the images from Gaza on his phone and resentment towards the university administration for their refusal to condemn the Zionist regime. On top of that, he said he was often distressed over the safety of his friends and colleagues who face being doxxed and harassed for speaking up for Palestine or the potential harm of death threats. The Palestinian student said, "I received a threatening phone call saying that they know where I live. So yes, being on campus has been sickening, but what has been helpful is the massive community support," the student said, alluding to the small village of tents and the community sitting behind him. Where the lack of institutional support for Palestinians has failed, the student said that the sit-in had provided much-needed solidarity. He said, "In addition to this sit-in being a form of protest, it is a community. I come here to drink tea and coffee and talk to people. They know that I am going through, and they allow me to be myself."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Puriza with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of the ongoing slaughter of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and beyond. Israel is escalating its attacks across the Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes have targeted Gaza's Indonesian hospital, where thousands are seeking refuge. At least 12 Palestinians have been killed there. Staff at the Indonesian hospital are appealing for urgent intervention from the UN and the Red Cross. Also, an Israeli attack on a residential building in Gaza's southern city of Rafah has killed at least 14 people. Gaza's health ministry director has dismissed Israel's claims that it had found a Hamas tunnel at the Al-Shifa hospital, describing it as a pure lie. Meantime, no calls for a ceasefire from Israel's allies, chiefly the United States. Here in the UK, a Scottish nationalist movement motion calling for an immediate ceasefire was voted down in the House of Commons this past week, leading to some opposition MPs resigning their front bench positions in protest. Meanwhile, national pro-Palestine protests are ongoing. The next one here in London is planned for November 25th. We'll be discussing the latest from Israel's war on the Palestinians and whether or not apartheid Israel has reached a tipping point, just like apartheid South Africa did in the 80s before coming to an end in the early 1990s. And joining me for the conversation in the studio, Dr. Matthew Alford, an author, filmmaker, and lecturer of politics, languages, and international studies at the University of Bath here in the UK, and via Skype from Dublin, Mohammed Desai, director of Africa for Palestine, the continent's largest Palestine solidarity human rights organization, and co-founder of Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions South Africa. Mohammed, of course, wears many other hats. He is in Dublin, but he's based in South Africa. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you. Matthew, well, this is now the second month of the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip and, of course, the killings that are going on in the West Bank. Your reflections so far?
Well, my reflections are that it is not just a major humanitarian disaster, but also a very significant geopolitical issue, which is going to have ramifications for years, if not decades, to come. I think it's interesting and perhaps even encouraging that there is a huge backlash to what Israel is doing and a huge cry for peace. Even in my own home city of Bath, which is a very small-C conservative Lib Dem city, for the first time in 10 years, for the first time since the Occupy movement, if you remember that, yeah. The anti-Wall Street movement, for the first time in 10 years, there were protests on the street just a couple of days ago, which I joined, which were peace protests that were opposed to all forms of terrorism. They were quite popular in the centre of Bath. So I think that however horrible this is, we should hold on to the possibility of a peaceful and beneficial outcome eventually.
Let me put the same question to Mohammed. 2 months of incessant bombings and shelling, a ground invasion, thousands of people dead. Your thoughts?
I think that one of the most tragic, but also one of the most apt descriptions of what we are seeing is has been described by one of the medical personnel in the Gaza Strip, a medical personnel actually from the United States, who described it as an avalanche of human suffering and devastation. I think that this is what we are seeing on the one hand, the Palestinians experiencing, but on the other hand, we're also seeing a certain barbaric form of cruelty being unleashed on the Palestinian people by the Israeli regime, of course, backed, supported, armed, and endorsed by the United States of America. And whilst we do have this sort of what I can only really describe as evilness being exerted and being imposed on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, I think at the same time it is very encouraging to see humanity coming together, whether it's from the streets of Johannesburg, the streets of Lusaka in Zambia, the streets of Tehran, the streets of London, and Dublin itself has seen some of the largest protests that this country has ever seen on the issue of Palestine. And so I do think there is a massive paradigm shift that is taking place across the globe. And at the same time, we're also seeing a shift within the way in which the Palestinian people are being portrayed in the media, and we are seeing, and I think that part of this is because of the cruelty on the one hand, but also I think that we must recognize the tenacity and the resilience of the Palestinian people that have not given up. Over the last 75 years, they have been waging a struggle. They have been insisting on their right to exist. And at the same time, they have been supported by their partners in the international solidarity movement.
I'm sure we will talk about the fact that the Palestinian resistance is there. It's not going to go anywhere, and no amount of brutal force is going to crush it. We'll get to that later. But let me ask Matthew this, and that is the number of people who have been murdered, nearly 12,000, among them thousands of children. How do you see this? Is this use of brutal force, barbaric force, an aim by Israel to tell its citizens, because it's, you know, myth of invincibility, that they're providing security, was shattered on October 7th?
I think that's right. I mean, traditionally, when there has been a flare-up in this conflict, Israel seems to have visited 10 to 15 times the casualty rate on their Palestinian enemy, as they see it. So it looks like they're already around about that figure now. Mm-hmm. But I think what is different about this particular phase of this long-running 75-year conflict is that I think there will be some kind of decisive political change, however that's manifest, that will affect the actual living conditions and the actual political structures of Israel and Palestine from now on. So I don't think it's just going to be a matter of Israel feeling like it's killed enough people mm-hmm. for it to feel secure. I think they're going to, in addition to doing that, mm-hmm. I think they're going to impose some kind of, or try to impose some kind of new political structure. But I think it does also, in terms of a human cost, I think we're still looking at several thousand people more that are going to lose their lives before Israel is even going to reveal that plan or it start to implement that plan in any meaningful way. And of course, Israel may not succeed, which could further elongate the escalation.
And that figure I mentioned excludes the people who are under the rubble and presumably dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's put this next question to Mohammed. We are still digesting the vote against a ceasefire in the UK Parliament and the UN vote in favor of a humanitarian pause. How did you see it?
Digesting it, I don't think that those of us in the global south even expected it. I think that we have become so used to the idea of a useless Western program of human rights and so-called speak of international law that in many ways those of us in the global south have learned a long time ago that international law and the idea of human rights is only reserved for Western countries and that it only gets used and weaponized against African African countries, countries in South America, countries in Asia and elsewhere. So I think that in some ways, this the last 4 weeks has really stripped the West and has really exposed the global North for the kind of facade that it has been imposing on the global community, but specifically when it comes to international politics and when it comes to international law. In many ways, those of us in the global South and that are viewing the ways in which the U.S., the way in which Britain and the European Union have reacted to this, to the current onslaught, to the current violence, and to the current attacks on the Gaza Strip. And many of us are asking not about the humanity that lies in Gaza, but we're really asking if the West actually possesses any sense of morality, any sense of humanity when it is allowing these kind of attacks to take place. And so in some ways, whilst we have lost hope in the West as coming to assist or coming to stop this kind of violence, I think that at the same time, we do appreciate international law, we do appreciate human rights, but we are going to make sure that they are implemented universally, that they are implemented without any prejudice to one group of people over another.
Right, which begs the question, you know, where do Palestinians draw their hope from? They have lost hope in the Western world, the Arab countries who own 1/6 of the world's wealth. They're not doing enough to put an end to the bloodshed, to say the least. But, gentlemen, we're going to pause here because we're going to hear from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, called on U.S. President Joe Biden to personally intervene to stop the war in Gaza. In a televised address broadcast over the weekend, Abbas spoke of the worsening humanitarian crisis in the besieged enclave.
President Biden, I urge you with all your official and humanitarian qualities to stop this humanitarian catastrophe, or rather this genocide against our innocent people, for which history will hold no one innocent, and to provide relief to our people trapped in Gaza. This war must be stopped immediately. How can this genocide be justified as self-defense? In reality, they're war crimes that deserve punishment. The horrific massacres committed by the Israeli occupation forces against our Palestinian people in Gaza, including the most recent ones in Al-Fakhoura and Tel Zatar schools today, which claimed the lives of hundreds of forcibly displaced people from their homes, once again compel me to demand that you and world leaders assume responsibility to stop this aggression and the crimes of genocide against our people. So far, over 42,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, have fallen victim, in addition to the widespread destruction of tens of thousands of homes, schools, hospitals, places of worship, public facilities, and infrastructure.
And we're back with our guests to continue the conversation. Matthew, I want to pick up on something we were discussing earlier. That's the United Nations. And when it comes to resolutions adopted against Iran, for example, you remember the Iraq War and the, you know, vial that Colin Powell held at the United Nations to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the UN seems to be able to implement those resolutions. But when it comes to Palestinians or the Gaza Strip or what's happening right now, it's completely toothless. Are they losing legitimacy altogether?
I think the United Nations is a great institution. I've been to the United Nations, and it's inspiring, really. But it's been toothless for a very long time. There was the hope, as I'm sure you know, in the aftermath of the Cold War in the 1990s, that the UN could finally be the thing that it was set up to be, to promote peace and self-determination, which is, of course, very relevant to the Palestinian people right now. And there was a growth in the relevancy of the United Nations in the 1990s, but only because it was driven so hard by the United States, and only because the United States was having its unipolar moment, its most powerful moment. Mm-hmm. After 9/11, the role of the United Nations, even that little uptick that it had in the 90s, it's really been a particularly toothless tiger since then. It's great that international law is there, and that's been set up by all of these countries working together, and it's so important for peace, security, and justice. But the last 20 years, it's not really been able to fulfill that mandate whatsoever.
Now, I mentioned we would be talking about apartheid Israel and apartheid South Africa. And Mohammed, this is a question for you. In the words of Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki, if there is any country or countries that can comprehend the suffering and the struggle for freedom and independence of Palestine, it is the African continent and the people of Africa. As a South African, watching these horrific events unfold, how do you, you know, see it all as far as apartheid is concerned?
So, Saeed, let me first maybe start off backwards. In some ways, what we are seeing is far, far worse and more horrific than what South Africans ever experienced during the days of apartheid. We never had F-16 bombers and Apache helicopters flying over our townships or flying over our residential areas, dropping bombs, missiles, and destroying entire buildings. We never saw the kind of death rate that we are currently witnessing in the Gaza Strip. So in many ways, even the very definition of Israel as an apartheid state is soon becoming irrelevant because we are more beginning to see it as a genocidal state. Our own president, and I don't use these words lightly, our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa, most recently has described what is happening to the Palestinian people as a genocide and as a Holocaust. Our ruling party, the African National Congress, has also made similar remarks, similar statements. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, the head of cabinet, the minister responsible for communicating all decisions from our administration, have all in the last 4 weeks described what is happening as a Holocaust and as a genocide. And so I do think that these two other words and definitions now need to be interrogated. However, to go to the issue of apartheid, I think that from the early 2000s, this is when the terms first started gaining traction. And it started gaining traction in a mainstream sense when the World Conference Against Racism took place in Durban in South Africa. It was at this conference that that organizations and governments started labeling Israel as an apartheid state in protest against the criticism that Israel and the Israeli regime was facing. The United States and Israel then boycotted and left that conference early. Thereafter, you have seen anti-apartheid icons from Winnie Mandela to Archbishop Desmond Tutu and to various others across the board that have described the situation of the Palestinian people as being very similar to that of the experience of Black South Africans under apartheid. However, I think that what has happened in the last 5 or 6 years is that we are now seeing not just a comparison between Israel and Israel's practices against the Palestinians to that of what apartheid South Africa imposed against Black South Africans. We're not just seeing a comparison, but we're also seeing a legal case being made that Israel Israel is committing the crime of apartheid as defined by the Rome Statute and again and by the International Convention on the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid. I think that the United Nations and especially the ICC's prosecutor, who comes from Britain actually, has had ample evidence put forward to him by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, and various others. And I really do think that it is that it is concerning that the prosecutor within the ICC has not made any substantial moves in order to prosecute and in order to bring Israel to the ICC.
It certainly is concerning. There are a lot of words, there's a lot of evidence, but we're yet to see any concrete action on the ground by these organizations and institutions. Let me move on to Matthew, if that's okay. And Matthew, do you think this is a tipping point? You know, in the 1980s, I think it was 85, when the minority rule in South Africa realized, look, you can crush the resistance, they're here to stay. And that sort of led to the downfall, if you will, or dismantlement of the apartheid system in the 1990s. Are we at that tipping point here in
the territories?
I think it's a really important question. It's very difficult to predict the future. Obviously, apartheid became an international lightning rod in the mid-1980s, but it still took another 5 years for actual on-the-ground results to occur. It might be that we're at that stage now with Palestine. I definitely think it is encouraging that there were a million people out, or close to a million people out on the streets in London just a week ago. Mm-hmm. And as I say, that it's spread into all sorts of other towns and cities and around the world. So I think this might be the kind of Black Lives Matter for Palestine, and that could have very serious and important ramifications for changing the world. Is it a tipping point? Very difficult to know. It's very difficult to know. There's certainly not much talk at the moment of a what a tipping point would mean, which would be a Palestinian state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the moment, I think it's one of those things that, you know, the night is darkest just before the dawn.
You don't think the end is nigh, so to speak?
Well, the end might be nigh in a different way, particularly if the conflict spreads. Mm-hmm. We do have there's a broader concern here, which takes us a little bit away from the initial humanitarian disaster that's going on, which is that, of course, a conflict like this could escalate. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've had similar situation in Ukraine as well. Yes. Since February 2022 in particular. And there is, of course, the other geostrategic fault line, which is in the Taiwan Straits, I know, and with China. Mm-hmm. And so there are these three areas at the moment, all of which could go spectacularly out of hand. And then your question of the is the end nigh would take on a rather dark, an even darker and more sinister meaning.
So far, only the threat of that happening.
Yeah.
It's a matter of wait and see, like they say. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Matthew, the story about the, you know, calls for criminal investigations into Israeli war crimes. So there's one thing. We're seeing certain countries, not all of them, of course, withdrawing, recalling their ambassadors. Mm. There's a call for boycotting Israeli products or cutting economic ties with it. Do you think it's going to become a trend? Or will all of this, any of this, have any real impact on the Israeli regime moving forward?
I think a lot of it depends on the intransigence of the American empire. I think they are very consciously aware of how their reign as the global hegemon is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And whether they're in denial about that, or certainly they know that they need to do something about that if they want to maintain that power. And Israel is a key part of that. Mm-hmm. Israel, as President Biden has said before, if Israel didn't exist, then we'd have had to have invented it. And that is because it is their strategic outpost for economic and political domination in that region. So it's going to be very difficult for the United States leadership to pull back from that. That's their stated position. That's where they really want to be.
Yeah.
And this can lead to perverse results as well, which can be really horrific. I was just thinking back to one of Fahima's stories that she picked up about this separation of North and South in Israel. I mean, it's the case.
In
Gaza. It's the case in during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. I looked at the statistics on this a few months ago. Obviously, the United States was there to protect the South of Vietnam, because that was where the democracy supposedly was, and against the communist dictatorship north. Over two-thirds of the bombs that were dropped were in the south.
Wow.
Because they were, you know, that old saying, you know, we had to destroy the village to save it. They basically destroyed a country to save it. Mm-hmm. And didn't do anything like as much in the north. Mm-hmm. So these kind of acts of domination can lead to very extremely destructive and perverse results. And those kind of things are going to start to happen now as this conflict heats up even further, particularly if we, I think, go beyond Christmas. I think there's a kind of a tacit understanding and acceptance that perhaps this is going to wind up sometime in December.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then all bets are off as to where this goes. I know that the Arab countries don't really want to be involved, but how can they justify that to their populations if we go into the new year and we're still in the same position?
You raise a very good question. Mohammed, this has been a PR battle as well as a physical one. It seems there are still attempts to shape the media narrative in this conflict. How do you see it?
So I think that, as Matthew had said, that the tipping point, the end of this, the end of and the dismantling of Israeli apartheid, in many ways will happen as the way in which it happened in South Africa, where it was a multitude of factors that then contributed towards the demise of the apartheid regime. It was the armed struggle, which played a vital and crucial role in our own liberation. It was the international community, and it was a civil disobedience on the ground and the underground as well. And so I think that likewise in the in this current situation that we are witnessing, I think that global empire and the U.S. domination is one factor, and that is already being challenged by, for example, the formation of BRICS or the rise of certain Latin American countries or Iran or various other countries to counter the sort of hegemony of the United States. Now, coming to the next part of it is the international, as you have put it, the sort of PR battle, the media battle. And I think that whilst on the one hand, U.S. platforms or U.S.-owned, U.S.-dominated platforms such as the Meta-controlled Instagram and Facebook, whilst we do have restrictions and we do have shadow bans and we have other sorts of limitations that people are experiencing, I think that we have, for one of the first times ever, we have seen, while notwithstanding these restrictions, we have seen the ability of Palestinian voices to be coming out onto the global stage. Whereas before, all media was controlled by the Israeli regime, any messaging had to go past the Israeli authorities.